Returning to Syria now, though, and the British government says it has legal advice which says it could launch strikes against the Syrian regime without the backing of the United Nations. Overnight, British MPs have been debating how to respond. Prime Minister David Cameron says he's convinced President Assad's regime was behind the chemical weapon attack.
Interfering in another country's affairs should not be undertaken except in the most exceptional circumstances. It must be, as my honourable friend just said, a humanitarian catastrophe, and it must be a last resort. But by any standards, this is a humanitarian catastrophe, and if there are no consequences for it, there is nothing to stop Assad and other dictators from using these weapons again and again.
That's British Prime Minister David Cameron speaking overnight. Since those comments, though, the British Prime Minister essentially lost the symbolic vote on military action in the House of Commons. In coming days, the UN Security Council will continue to debate this issue of whether and how to intervene in Syria. But while the moral case for taking military action against the Assad regime may be compelling to some, the legal case is not so straightforward. Gareth Evans was Australia's foreign minister from 1988 to 1996. He also co-chaired the 2001 International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, which initiated the concept of responsibility to protect, a new international norm designed to protect citizens from attack by their own state. R2P, as it's known, was eventually adopted unanimously by the UN in 2005, and it was the foundation for the Security Council-endorsed military action against Libya in 2011. Gareth Evans, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Good morning, Fran.
Gareth Evans, the vote has gone down in the British Parliament, first time around in the Commons, but earlier this morning, the British government says it now has legal advice which says it can act against Syria militarily even without a UN mandate. What do you think of that legal advice?
Well, I've read the legal advice, and I'm afraid it's not very compelling on the issue of legality, although it perfectly well makes the case on the issue of morality or legitimacy, if you like. There is, unfortunately, a distinction of this kind we have to draw, because the reality is that, however an extreme a breach of international law might be, and that seems to have been the case in Syria, that doesn't in itself legally authorise a coercive military response. Under the UN Charter, it has to be either self-defence or there has to be a specific mandate from the Security Council, which clearly is going to be blocked here by Russia. The idea that there's some kind of additional rule of customary international law hovering around, which enables you in extreme situations of humanitarian emergency where military action is a last resort and other prudential criteria satisfied, the idea that there's some kind of customary international law basis for military action outside the Charter has been around for quite a long time, but I'm afraid it just doesn't stand up. And that's what the whole debate was about the responsibility to protect. Mm. And the UN General Assembly in 2005 addressed this issue very squarely and said there's a clear responsibility on the international community to respond in a timely and decisive fashion if a country is perpetrating or allowing genocide or other mass atrocities, crimes to occur on its own territory, but that in itself won't justify a military response as distinct from sanctions or other forms of pressure unless the Security Council mandate is expressly there. So we're in a terrible dilemma here, because I think here the moral case is pretty strong and all the criteria for legality that have been set out by the British do in fact certainly apply to making a moral judgment. But I think we're just in this twilight zone where we've been so often, where we do have to recognise that the legal case is weak and just put all our eggs in the moral justification basket. And I think,
well, let's talk about how we do that, because as you say, we're in this twilight zone, which is why I think the UN and you and others work to come up with this responsibility to protect doctrine to try and help us through these twilight zones that otherwise might be referred to as Rwanda or Kosovo. And we came up with the R2P doctrine, which was used as a foundation for military action in Libya and in the Ivory Coast in 2011. So I think a lot of people were thinking it was used then. Why can't it be used for Syria? The case seems pretty clear, providing we get the evidence.
Yeah, provided we get the evidence, the case is overwhelming for, I think, the Security Council to endorse this action. The problem is if they don't, where are you? I think the way to approach this is to say that if some moral criteria or criteria of legitimacy can be satisfied, of the kind that the British have in fact identified, then you can possibly say to the international community something like a plea in mitigation in domestic law. I ran the red light, yes, I broke the law, but my wife was having a baby in the back seat at the time, and I was justified in doing it. I think that kind of response is better understood in the wider international community than playing games with the concept of legality, as the Brits are clearly trying to do. What are those criteria of morality or legitimacy? Mm-hmm. Very quickly, number one is the gravity of the harm, and I think an issue, and that's clearly established here. And the use of chemical weapons lifts the harm involved to a whole new dimension of horror. Secondly, there's the issue of last resort. Would anything other than a military response give the signals that are necessary to the Assad regime to deter it from doing anything similar in practice? Mm-hmm. In the future, answer probably no, that criterion is satisfied. Third criterion is the intent, the motive. Are you doing this with a genuine civilian protection objective in mind, or is it to, you know, look after the oil price or whatever? I think that would be clearly satisfied here. Mm-hmm. Criterion of proportionality is another one that comes into play. The nature of the response has to be tailored to the nature of the offence. And so anything which savoured of a full-scale regime change enterprise would clearly, you know, be out of the question here as an appropriately tailored response to this particular provocation. And the final criterion is balance of consequences. At the end of the day, is a military strike going to in fact cause more damage to those people you are aiming to protect than would be the case if you didn't go down that route? And that's very often a real world problem, and mm-hmm. that's one of the issues that is part of the debate at the moment in Syria. Would a military strike actually deter the Assad regime or just further inflame an already catastrophic civil war?
And I guess that comes back to that question of proportionality and pinpointing where you would strike and how you warn the civilian populations around those areas. But underpinning all of those isn't the key question. Before you go through those and tick off those five, is the weight of the evidence, and this is what undid Iraq, of course, the weapons for mass destruction that were claimed were not there. Do we need to see the evidence before this argument goes any further?
Yes, we do. I mean, nobody can afford another debacle like Iraq in 2003. The US, the UK, countries like Australia travelling with them, absolutely not. Now, what's that evidence going to be? It does seem to be, from what we're being told in the press leaks and so on, some pretty compelling electronic evidence, spy-in-the-sky stuff, intercepting conversations, and that, at the end of the day, may well be more compelling than anything the inspectors are able to come up with or any physical evidence that's available on the ground. But if the US does have that kind of information, as reluctant as it might well be to disclose its sources and so on, I think it's unquestionably got to put this on the table if it's going to command any kind of international support for what it's doing on that sort of plea and mitigation principle that I explained before.
What is the chance that the US and Britain would act unilaterally and launch a military strike without UN backing, like in Iraq in 2003? Do you think the pressure of those days are gone, or in fact have we gone so far now in this case with the US president vowing that the Syrian government would face international consequences for last week's chemical weapons attack, that is going to happen, UN or no UN? Do you see that as moving over that red line now?
I think they're probably inexorably set on this particular path, but I think they are with a much higher level of prima facie justification than was the case in 2003. I mean, 2003 was indefensible from almost any single way in which you look at it, and we haven't got time to track back over that now. But here, provided that evidence does stack up and it's put on the table, the arguments in terms of them, you know, what can satisfy those prudential criteria or legitimacy criteria that I mentioned, even if they don't satisfy the formal legal one, are all pretty strong in this case and all pretty compelling in a way that simply, you know, wasn't the case in 2003. So I think the US and UK have it, and France have at least that much on their side. But what is really critical here is that we try and keep the maximum possible degree of international consensus about the way in which we handle these atrocity crime cases. It's catastrophic that the Russians have been cynical as they have all the way through, and diplomacy really has to be sort of centre front, and we have to work very, very hard to re-establish that consensus, which we did have at the time of Libya, but which we rather blew, I'm afraid, because of the perceived overreach of the US, UK and France and the way they actually conducted the Libyan mandate.
Just on that, it's 8:15, we're speaking with former Foreign Minister Gareth Evans. Just on the Libya thing, blowing that mandate, was that because, in your view, the response or the attack really was not proportional? Was that the key problem there? Or, in fact, the result, the aftermath of it, which we see in Libya now?
Look, in short, the mandate was given by the Security Council was to stop a massacre being perpetrated in Benghazi, which everybody anticipated would be the case, and to generally address the question of civilian protection. That very quickly morphed into a pretty explicit regime change enterprise, articulated as such by the US, UK and France, on the argument that the only way you could protect civilians was by knocking out Gaddafi completely, but that was not accepted by the wider community. People wanted a more calibrated response, and that generated the perception that you give these characters an inch, they'll take a mile, and under those circumstances, that's more than anything else is what's inhibited the paralysis. That's what's inhibited any kind of consensual action over Syria since mid-2011.
So what
I think we've got to do is just regain an understanding of what the criteria are, the issues are, and try and regenerate that consensus that was there around the responsibility to protect principle.
So just on that, and just finally, is this the biggest test to date for the responsibility to protect doctrine, and can it survive?
Well, it's surviving remarkably well in terms of a general embrace of the basic norm about countries' own responsibility, other countries to assist them, and the use of sanctions and international criminal court prosecutions and other things. It's always going to be very difficult when you've got these extreme cases where prima facie there's a case for the use of military force. Military force is always going to be contested, always going to be the subject of argument. So I think it is very, very important that we get this debate back on the rails. And in that context, much, much better to be very explicit. No, we don't have formal legal justification. We wish we did, but we don't. There is a moral case here. It's an overwhelming one. It's an exceptional case. We're not challenging the whole rule-based international order. We're just doing what we've got to do in this case, as was Kosovo, for example. And I think if you put it on that basis, you've got the beginnings of recapturing a consensus, which has desperately, unhappily been lost at the moment.
Gareth Evans, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Thank you for it.
Gareth Evans, Australia's former foreign minister and also co-chair of the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty in 2001, is the author of The Responsibility to Protect, Ending Mass Atrocity Crimes Once and for All. It's 8:18.